This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a Democratic senator wants to make all the illegal things that U.S. spies do legal. A military unit that is complicit in the genocide in Congo is defeated. And it's time for a reckoning at the African Studies Department at Temple University.
But first, the fate of mostly black Detroit has been unfolding in the courtroom of U.S. bankruptcy judge Stephen Rhodes. Rhodes rejected the local NAACP's argument that bankruptcy proceedings should be halted because the people of Detroit have been disenfranchised and have no say in the matter. All power in Detroit is wielded by Kevin Orr, the emergency financial manager appointed by the Republican governor. Nevertheless, some folks in Detroit went through the motions of a citywide election last week as if their votes really mattered. We spoke with Abiyomi Azikiwe, a political activist and editor of the Pan-African Newswire.
Well, the city has been somewhat distracted by the elections for mayor and city council that took place just this last past Tuesday. And, of course, that has brought about some stark contradictions because for the first time in 44 years, you have a white mayor who's been elected to the city of Detroit. But it's secondary from the standpoint that the real power that's impacting Detroit has nothing to do with the city hall. Offices of the mayor of the city council has more to do with the corporate boardrooms of the banks and the transnational firms that are really behind the whole crisis in Detroit.
And how have their interests fared in Judge Rhodes' court?
Well, it remains to be seen. He's given the appearance as if he wants to hear all sides of the argument. There's been some damning testimony on the part of people who are opposed to this bankruptcy going forward. Even the state treasurer, Dillon, who is a Democrat who was on the right wing of the Democratic Party but was appointed by Governor Snyder as the treasurer and also to be over Detroit as an overseer prior to the intervention of the emergency management. His testimony was really amazing because even he said he felt uneasy about the way in which the whole process was carried out. There's been objections filed by over 110 people, just ordinary citizens in the city of Detroit, retirees, homeowners, young people, senior citizens. And at the same time, there are additional hearings that are going to be taking place, which are really going to be important. There's a swap deal, which they're trying to ram through outside the bankruptcy process. They tried to get the city council 2 weeks ago to approve a $350 million loan from Barclays Bank. Barclays, of course, being involved in the LIBOR scandal and other problems in Britain as well as internationally, to refinance the interest rate swaps. The interests are due on these swaps coming up very soon. $350 million the city of Detroit would have been pledged to turn over to the banks outside the bankruptcy proceeding because they didn't want these issues to be litigated in the bankruptcy court. So that is going to be litigated because the city council, for the first time in many, many years, voted against the banks. They turned down the deal offered by Barclays through the emergency manager unanimously. This was historic, even surprised ourselves.
You say that vote was historic in that the city council went against the interests of the bank, but of course that vote occurred during this period in which the city council has no power.
Yes, and they're going to still try to push it through, but the judge has not approved it. It has to be approved by the bankruptcy court. So this coming Tuesday, we're going to have a action at Bank of America, which is one of the largest holders of the municipal debt in the city of Detroit. So we're still going to try to impact this deal. It should not go through. It's no way in the world we should be giving the banks an additional $350 million for no reason.
Also, under the terms of Kevin Orr, the emergency financial manager's plan, if for any reason there was no emergency financial manager, if the courts threw the statute out or for any other reason the financial manager regime ended, then the city of Detroit could declare it in default by Barclays, which is the super priority lender.
That's a very important point, because anything over $10 million would essentially have a lien placed against it. So Belle Isle, the Detroit Institute of Arts, the Detroit Public Lighting, which they've already established the Detroit Public Lighting Authority, would be up for grabs by Barclays or any other creditors, particularly those in the financial sector, who claim that the city of Detroit owes them money. Yes.
So it seems that under Orr's plan, Detroit would never escape the clutches of some kind of manager.
Yes, and this is what is important, and this is what people around the country need to see, that the powers that be have no solution to this crisis. From the White House and Wall Street all the way down to the state capitals, to the county boards, to the school districts, to the municipal governments, to the city councils, what is being articulated is merely a continuation of what already exists. They're just offering more debt to float more bonds. There's no discussion about jobs, economic opportunities, repopulating the cities, restoring houses, providing health care for everybody, providing quality education for everyone. That is not the narrative. The narrative is austerity and more austerity.
And the discussion within the National Democratic Party does not seem to focus on the disenfranchisement of not just the people of Detroit, but more than half of the black folks of Michigan.
They don't even mention the word jobs. They don't mention the word poverty. They don't mention the word racism. They don't mention the word low wages. None of these issues that have impacted the majority of the people in the United States are even being discussed. Look at the debacle right now involving the Affordable Health Care Program in Washington, D.C. And the president has to go on national television and apologize for saying that we have 14 million people who are receiving letters saying that their health care systems are being terminated for something that they don't even know what it will look like in the future. So this is a serious crisis, political crisis, ideological crisis on the part of the ruling class. And, of course, this trickles all the way down to the local level as well.
Now, this new mayor is not only white, but he received the support of the very same corporate interests in Detroit.
Yes, but the point is that going back 40 years when Coleman Young was elected in 1973, even at that time, there was a section of the auto industry and the ruling class in Detroit who actually supported Coleman Young to come into office because the city was on the verge of a civil war. I mean, you had the stress to stop the robberies in Joy Safe Streets, decoy police unit that had killed over 30 African Americans in the city over a period of 2 years, and people had taken up arms against the police. This was even years after the 1967 rebellion. So there was a real fear of social unrest. And at that time in 1973, a lot of the auto plants, which have since closed and moved out and set up shop in other parts of the United States and overseas, were very much in full swing in 1973. And you had a lot of unrest in the plants, wildcat strikes, people walking off the job because it was too hot inside the factories. All of this contributed to the restructuring of industry inside the United States, and Detroit, of course, was at the center of industry, not only in the U.S., but indeed the world. So now we have a situation where the traditional role of African-American mayors that they played, for example, in Cleveland and Gary in Detroit, in Chicago under Harold Washington, that role has been pretty much eliminated. And what we have now is a total subservience to the banks, to the corporations, and to the ruling political interests inside the United States. So it's very little real independent African-American political authority that's been exercised in any major city throughout the United States today. I saw an extensive interview with the mayor of Philadelphia on the BBC television, and he was in Britain trying to drum up economic investment for Philadelphia, and the interviewer was an African woman, British, who asked him some very pointed questions about unemployment or whether or not the federal government had a program to address the growing poverty among African Americans and so forth. And he really had no concrete answers to any of these questions, you know, because you get a lot of the conservative rhetoric that you even hear from the White House, that black men need to go to school, they need to stay out of trouble, they need to take care of their children and all this in a very condescending type manner. But there's no responsibility placed on those who have historically looted and exploited and oppressed the African community here in the United States. There's no responsibility placed on these forces for the current crisis that exists today. The hundreds of thousands of our people who are in prison, the millions more who are unemployed and trapped in poverty, there's no real issues that are being raised by the Democratic Party and by these establishment politicians that address these issues. They're going to have to come from the grassroots, and we're going to have to go directly to the people who are responsible and bypass many of these political officials and political operatives of both the Democratic and the Republican Party. And if you look at the new mayor of Detroit, he was essentially imposed. He should never have even been on the ballot because he had not been a resident of the city long enough, and that was challenged. He was thrown off the regular ballot, and then he was allowed to run as a write-in candidate. They spent at least $3 million in campaigning, and then there was even evidence of massive fraud in the primary elections during August, which was ignored by the State Election Commission. And he was the CEO of the Detroit Medical Center, which was a nonprofit entity when he entered the institution. And now it has been privatized. It has been sold twice. There have been hundreds of layoffs. And this is the same program they want to exercise for the city of Detroit as well.
That was Abiyomi Ezekwe of the Pan-African Newswire speaking from Detroit.
The black mayor of Richmond, Virginia, is determined to turn the city's historical section into a baseball stadium at the insistence of local business groups. The neighborhood is called Shaco Bottom. At one time, it was the second largest slave market in the United States, right behind Charleston, South Carolina. Anna Edwards is an activist with Richmond's Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality. She explains why Shaco Bottom's legacy is worth more than a baseball stadium.
It is the original city of Richmond. It is the center of the slave trade from the early 19th century right to the end of the Civil War. It is the place where the black history of Richmond is born and is told through existing resources, existing architecture, existing archaeological sites, as well as Richmond's African burial ground, which is the oldest municipal burial ground where black people could be buried in the city of Richmond.
And you have a black mayor who wants to expunge that black history.
We do. And the reason he's doing it really doesn't even have anything to do with whether or not he's pro-history or anti-history at all. It's money. And Shaco Bottom is the price that he is willing to pay for the developers to make their money on the site where the current baseball stadium is. The North Boulevard site, where the diamond sits right now, is actually the primary target of this development project. And what they are saying is that if they don't get that, they won't be able to pay for a stadium anywhere. And that Shaco Bottom represents the place where their studies have demonstrated the most economic return is free. But we know that it has nothing to do with that, and economic studies do not show that baseball stadiums provide that kind of an economic driver.
So a baseball stadium pig in the poke that probably won't make any money, probably will lose money for the city, trumps the legacy.
That's exactly what it does. And the other thing that's interesting is that the criteria that they established for assessing whether or not Shaco Bottom is a good site for this is one, which there are three sites proposed, and what they want to see is which site will create the most jobs, that's one. Two is which site will pay for itself, and three is which one can be completed by 2016. Now, the kind of development that they are talking about is not just a baseball stadium. It is also, the newspaper report said that they've already got a commitment from a major hotel chain and a major retailer. We know there's a grocery store planned. And in addition, there will be more retail, residential, and commercial development along with it. It's a $78 million ballpark with ancillary development around it. So what they are talking about doing will be so disruptive as to eliminate the possibility of developing as an historic district and destroy the what has already been discovered. What they are saying is that this money is going to allow them to build a slavery museum and to protect the Lumpkins Jail archaeological site, the Slave Trail Walk, and the African Burial Ground. But they're not talking about how that could be done. And in any event, any development that they think on that scale they're going to complete by 2016 is a shell game, because you can't do that level of work, including floodplain alleviation, by 2016. They don't even have final plans yet. It hasn't gone through public review. They haven't done any community input yet. 2014 is a minute away, and how they anticipate being able to complete such a project by 2016 without doing it in a very slipshod manner is remarkable to me.
I'm sure that the defenders of freedom, justice, and equality, the group to which you belong, will have something to say in terms of that community input.
We presented not only the 37 scholars' signatures, but also at that time we had 1,600 signatures on a petition from people throughout the Richmond area, including an online petition which also had maybe 25% of the signatures from people outside of Virginia. And the local newspaper did a poll that only polled about 700 people, and even their poll resulted in two-thirds opposed to a stadium in Chaco Bottom. So we have a lot of community support for this position, and there are many, many reasons why other people don't want it there, but it has come down to, feasible or not, it is an inappropriate site to place a baseball stadium and this kind of development, because it will destroy the oldest, most unique section of Richmond that tells not only Richmond's Black history, but Richmond's history.
Anna Edwards of Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality in Richmond, Virginia.
In Florida, a Black mother and formerly battered wife remains in jail on aggravated battery charges for firing a warning shot into the ceiling of her home to deter her ex-husband from attacking her in 2010. A national campaign has grown around the demand to free Marissa Alexander. And Jacksonville, we spoke with Alita Austin Toure of the Free Marissa Movement.
This case is all about an African-American mother of three, survivor of domestic violence. She caused no injuries. There was no criminal background record. And despite the fact that the Florida self-defense law includes the right to stand your ground, okay, and we just had a legislation in Florida based on Marissa's case, that just came out in Tallahassee regarding Stand Your Ground and how it didn't work for her. So now, you know, it's even being voted on in Florida state capitol as we speak. So they basically realized that the case had to start over. Okay. So in changing the factor that, okay, all charges have been dropped, let's start over. Should we drop the case altogether and let her walk free? Or the second thing, which is what's happened last week, which is, no, let's have a new trial and start over. You know, so therefore there was already this inconsistency, knowing that Marissa, there was some things with the minimum mandatory and the fact that she is trying to stand her ground. So because she has no previous record, because the whole stance that even as a domestic violence survivor, none of that information is going into the case, because her ex-husband, strange husband, went into a domestic violence center after the shot was put into the ceiling to call the police and make himself the victim, she was victimized again, you know, meaning she's had reports from the police. She's been in the hospital. That's why her daughter was born, because she was a preemie because of the abuse that Marissa suffered. So she was victimized even by the state, because her husband was considered and put himself into a place to say he's the victim in this case. And it's in record. So they're fighting, who should we defend? And so this is what's happening with the criminalization of Black women. If we look at the historical pretense of Angela Davis, you know, there was a time we all wore the Angela Davis buttons, and the whole factor, you know, she's criminalized, this is how it's going to be, let's show her off, go going into the airplane. Everyone knows that site. And then come to find out she's now talking about the prison industrial complex with women, but race and class, and she's a well-known professor and author. Same thing with Assata Shakur. And so, you know, I'm saying all of this to really just talk about the social justice aspect of this, because of the systemic racism that still exists. It's a systemic piece on, you know, stopping mass incarceration and deliberate indifference. She is still not home with her children on bond, even though there's no charges for her. She's still imprisoned, and she's still waiting to at least go home with her children. She can't. We're praying right now that she goes home with her children for the holidays before this March 31st retrial. And there is a justifiable cause for rage and protest from people, and that is why people really got upset during the Zimmerman verdict afterwards. And with that, you know, because of the violence and the racism embedded in Florida criminal justice system, this is not the time, you know, people are to shut up, but to show up and turn the rage into resistance, you know, through organized and peaceful protests, which is what we're doing. We had 300 members in Free Marissa Now on our Facebook. Now we well have over almost 3,000. And so we need to build, we're constantly talking about a movement to stop the racist murder and the race, sex, and class bias in the courts. And we're encouraging people to use the resources to organize and voice, to speak truth to power and create change. And what Marissa says to me when I speak to her loudly, she's one woman that's being used as a vessel. She's a very spiritual woman. In her pieces, it's happening to me, but this is happening all the time. She's talking about she has a master's degree, so she's very eloquent, very spiritual, and she constantly says, I've been chosen to be the vessel because it's much bigger than me. And what she's saying is it's about the prison industrial complex. You know, so we walked this thing called the Dignity Walk, which is leaving Jacksonville, Florida, and for 6 days we walked nonstop, walking for dignity. Our demands were the resignation of Angela Corey and the release of Marissa Alexander, who received this 22-year sentencing, and the end of genocide and, of course, mass incarceration. And what we're saying to people is that there is no getting around this is unjust. There is, you know, but in fact, with the laws that we have in this state, until we get to the systemic racism and change the legislation, but more importantly, mobilizing the people to leave the complacency, to get on board. And so what I ask, if you can go to, first of all, our Tumblr page, which is freemarissanow.tumblr.com. There's places where you can talk, you can see the actions. There's a place where you can see the endorsers. And I'm talking about Australia. I'm talking about Canada. I'm talking about the young people in Los Angeles, California that did a music video, and the group in Colorado that's opening up their coffee shops just to sign the petitions to send to Angela Corey, the DA here, as well as the governor. And more importantly, that men show up. In the eve of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, we are saying 50 years later, we still have sexism within the civil rights movement. We still have women who are doing most of the work. And so where do we talk then about domestic violence and sexual assault within our own communities? Because of the divide now, black people are going into the middle class. Okay, so there's the working class and the lower class, but there's still the woman, and these issues of domestic violence and the criminalization of women of color that aren't being talked about. So we ask people, you know, let's get out of our comfortableness on and running as a victory from the March on Washington and get back to work to say there's still a fight.
So we have a situation in which black women are 2.5 times as likely to be killed by a male as white women are, and they are subject to malicious prosecution by the state.
Yes. And that is why it spoke loudly that Trayvon Martin's family and those during the climate of George Zimmerman trial, it was not only the criminalization of a young black boy like Trayvon Martin, but it also a woman. You know, and what that says is that, you know, we're building to that force that, yes, both are being looked at. Stop and frisk is looking at our youth, but the prison industrial complex is looking at another means of slavery. It's called slavery by another name. And so putting Marissa in is another part of that DMC statistics, which is domestic disproportionate minority contact. But that's what Angela Corey wanted, because she wants to give out 1 million people into prisons before she retires. She's quoted this in the news. She wants this. So that says to us, there's racial disparities. When she meets with the young boys that I met, brought to her office, she says, no, there's no racial disparities. And we show her the statistics. And the elephant in the big room is always at our $350 million courthouse. The elephant is racism.
That was Alita Austin Ture in Jacksonville.
California Senator Dianne Feinstein, the chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, has been a staunch defender of the National Security Agency's massive spying on Americans and on people all over the world. Feinstein recently introduced a bill that would legalize the NSA's current practices and possibly allow U.S. spies even more leeway. In Washington, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee is gearing up to fight Feinstein's legislation. Matthew Carragrew is a legal fellow for the Defense Committee.
The FISA Improvement Act is a cynical attempt at codifying what already exists in terms of a lack of oversight, in terms of NSA overreach, and a kind of total avoidance of constitutional protections.
Now, there's also a bill in the Congress that people are comparing to the Feinstein bill. It's the Sensenbrenner and Leahy legislation. It looks pretty tepid, though.
The Sensenbrenner, the Leahy-Sensenbrenner bill is also called the USA Freedom Act. And what it does is a couple of important things that are a step in a direction towards reining in the Patriot Act and reining in out-of-control government surveillance. So one of the most important things that happens in the USA Freedom Act is an establishment of an oversight board that has appeal power over FISA and can review FISA decisions and make disclosures and is specifically privacy-oriented. So that's a huge difference between the USA Freedom Act and the FISA Improvement Act that Feinstein is pushing through. Feinstein wants less disclosure. The FISA Improvement Act doesn't really improve anything. What it does is it codifies and extends NSA powers by saying the NSA cannot do bulk collections except when, and then outlining actually a program that is much broader than already exists, or at least as broad as already exists. It's hard to know because we don't have any oversight, because we can't get any reports from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FISC court that's authorized under the FISA Act. So USA Freedom Act is not a full repeal of the Patriot Act, which I think would be a step in the direction, a really pronounced and profound step in the right direction in terms of reining in the surveillance state. What it does do, though, is it limits the NSA component and specifically Section 215 of the Patriot Act. And the thing that's most powerful about the USA Freedom Act is that Sensenbrenner wrote the Patriot Act. So this is a person who is the architect of a lot of this body of law, which has sort of been twisted and contorted to result in the types of surveillance that we're seeing now, basically coming out and saying, this is not what we wrote the Patriot Act for. This is unconstitutional and unlawful, and we need stronger oversight. So this person, Sensenbrenner, and the USA Freedom Act, while not a sweeping transformation, is light years beyond the FISA Improvement Act and what Feinstein has put forward. Tepid, perhaps, but still with enough impact to be meaningful.
Do you foresee that we'll see a coalition of progressive Democrats and libertarian Republicans gathering support for this bill?
Yes, I do. I live here in California, and there's been a broad trajectory of libertarian and progressive cooperation, specifically around California's AB 351, which was recently passed and signed into law this year, which limits California's participation under the National Defense Authorization Act. It basically prohibits indefinite detentions. So when you get into government overreach, and you start getting into programs like NSA data collection and policing actions like indefinite detention, you do start to see a lot of libertarian progressive crossover. And I think that that's because both libertarians and progressives, while differing in tremendous and meaningful ways on certain pieces of policy, have largely been failed by the Democratic Party and by the GOP. And I think that that's increasingly true for most people. Like many, many people who are engaged in civil liberties work, for instance, have no avenue of remedy. There's nowhere to go within the traditionally established party structure. And what that's doing is it's causing very uncommon alliances that sort of break out of the type of partisanship to create these sorts of transpartisan allies, alliances, around specific issues, particularly when it comes to surveillance and particularly when it comes to policing. Now, what I think is really good about that is there's a broad coalition capable of voicing many different perspectives on why a program like the FCA's data collection program and why bills like the FISA Improvement Act are bogus. But more to the point, in terms of advancing a political conversation, in terms of advancing our ability to work together to solve these kinds of problems going forward, I think that these types of partnerships open up a kind of dialogue around political differences that we are just denied at the national and congressional level through mainstream political parties. And so I think that both, you know, I hesitate to call them sides because there's many sides. There's not only two, is what I'm saying. Both libertarians and progressives working together on these bills don't just see allyships and don't just see alliances and don't see progress on the specific issues themselves. I think we're actually experiencing an advancement of political dialogue coming from way outside the established political sphere that sort of is good for everybody. A rising tide sort of raises all boats in that regard, and libertarians and progressives and everybody kind of in that mix all the way across that spectrum benefits from having an advanced political discussion that's real and rooted in lived experience in our actual lives and isn't so insane as sort of what we get through mainstream political parties. So I think that we're going to see those kinds of partnerships for more reasons than just a relevant point shared between groups. I think it's like those types of partnerships advance a political dialogue that helps everybody fight these things better and kind of makes our own political criticisms, no matter where you sit on that spectrum, sharper in a way that traditional engagement with the political machine really doesn't.
You were speaking of preventive detention. Preventive detention is now the law of the land thanks to a Democratic bill, thanks to President Obama. Many folks believe that no Republican could have passed that kind of legislation.
Yeah, I think that that's true. I mean, indefinite detention under the National Defense Authorization Act, and I'll just go back and say that that bill is renewed every year. It has been renewed every year. It sets the budgets and the priorities and the limitations of every policing organization at the national level. And so in 2013, it was really earmarked and put aside. There are funding, personnel, and specific law put in place to conduct indefinite detentions, which, you know, let's be clear, is Guantanamo-style detentions of American citizens on American soil. And what that is it's historical blindness. I mean, it's a lack of historical memory around Japanese internment. It's like things that we experienced in the 20th century where fears around national security led to the indefinite and unlawful detention. Well, I mean, at the time, the constructed law for it. But looking backwards now, the law that permitted the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II and that period of time is morally invalid. And we don't look back at that period of time and be like, oh, that was good law. You know, at least it was lawful. No, the whole thing is repugnant. And so putting into place the legal architecture to replicate that is just an act of historical blindness. And I think that you're right that it probably couldn't have been passed by a Republican. And the reason why is because Republicans, especially right now, are severely distracted and fractured, which you'd think if the stereotypes around Democrats as being advocates of social justices and liberties like they would like to see themselves as would capitalize on this moment of disorganization in terms of what's going on within the Republican Party. But instead, what we've really seen is that there isn't much of a difference between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party when it comes to anything but minor social issues. When it comes to policing, when it comes to militarism, when it comes to drones, the differences between Republicans and Democrats is really one of voter credibility. And I think that what the Obama administration did was leverage the silence of its Democratic constituents to basically push through not just the indefinite detention provision of the NDAA, but a whole host of domestic and foreign policy regulations and rules that are like...
And the Feinstein bill is bad news for whistleblowers, isn't it?
The Feinstein bill puts a specific provision in that is a direct reaction to the Snowden disclosures that criminalizes any disclosure around, you know, a FISA ruling or an FISC ruling. So it's like, whereas previously it's already a crime to reveal government secrets, Feinstein puts in a specific part that if you reveal anything relating to the NSA or to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, anything that's covered under that authority, there's an additional criminal penalty. And it's just sort of like a kick in the teeth to whistleblowers or any aspiring whistleblowers or anybody that would have information like that. So not only does it not do anything to rein in the NSA and to curtail the FISC's ability to authorize this type of surveillance, but it stops people from talking about it from within theirs. It's like a layer cake of really bad ideas. You know, Democrats were complicit in the passage of the Patriot Act in the first place. You know, Democrats time and time and time again, when Republican-led laws that have come, you know, when George Bush was sort of as the president and we had a different political composition, Democrat voter constituencies, people on the street were extraordinarily vocal with their discontent, but our Democratic elected representatives voted to go to war. They voted in the Patriot Act. And honestly, I think that there could have been more of a media campaign against why a Democrat might support indefinite detention with a sitting Republican president, but I wouldn't put it past them at all to have passed it anyway. I think that the popular discontent would have been broad, but it seems in the last decade that the Democrats don't really care about what people are doing on the ground and what popular opinion is. Now, this is specifically pertaining to policing. I mean, I think that sometimes the real differences are between Republicans and Democrats when it comes to certain parts of healthcare bills and voter access and marriage equality and that kind of thing. And those are important social issues, but in terms of national security and domestic policy and policing policy, Democrats and Republicans have stood side by side over the last decade.
Let me get you to speculate about the application of these vast surveillance powers that the NSA has. What possible uses would an American intelligence agency have for spying on 40 million or 60 million Spaniards?
Yeah, right. The Spanish, our old nemesis. No, I think that the technology for this type of data collection is fairly new. And so the applications for this type of data are also fairly new and are kind of like on a new horizon. And so, you know, what makes in a sort of Occam's razor kind of simplest explanation might be true way, the NSA data collection programs are really about what's going to be available 5 years from now. How is this data going to be usable, you know, 3 years from now? If you think about what was available in 2010 and what was available in 2013 in terms of facial recognition software, you know, where, you know, you have Google that's trying to make it so that you can search an image of a face and it uses biometric scans. Well, a lot of that technology was developed with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And it's sort of, you know, the NSA is one piece. It's a data collection piece of a larger policing schema. And so the applications for this kind of data, as they exist now, may in fact be fairly limited. You know, it may be that they don't have a tremendous amount of specific use for every phone call record in Spain or every phone call record in the United States for that matter. But what they might have and what I know that they're anticipating having is rapid and increasing advances in technology that's going to make that data more and more and more deployable to the point where you would be able to see a person's face and then through that person's face and a network of computers know literally everything about them. That's so far ahead of what courts have considered in terms of Fourth Amendment regulation. This is technology that is sort of equivalent to dynamite or the Gatling gun or the atom bomb in terms of a massive technological transformation that so far exceeds what's come before it that the actual implications of it can't fully be understood. So what does the NSA want with all this data? What are they doing with it right now? We're getting really good at aggregating it. In the future, the potential for the usage and deployment of this data against individuals for any reason that they choose. And we've already seen through the last century that governments, when threatened politically, often turn their policing apparatuses against their political enemies. And I think that it is completely historically in line to assume that if there's a massive data collection program that's going on like this, and there are technological developments that are going to hone and refine the government's ability to deploy this information in a way that is going to increase their ability to police individuals, that that's going to come out against political opponents. And so what are they doing with it now? It's sort of anybody's guess. What do they want to do with it in the future is have as much information. It's a technology that doesn't even exist yet. It's basically the deal.
Sounds like we need a kind of Magna Carta when confronting technology that is exploding at that kind of rate.
Yeah, I agree. And that's actually a great comparison because I think that the problem, you know, capital P, the problem, if we're really going to get super zoomed out and big picture about it, is that the state is on a trajectory towards an increasing level of surveillance and an increasing role for policing. And that the technology itself is a tool. You know, a hammer can be used to build a home. It can be used to bash in a skull. It's the technology itself doesn't just by nature of existing implicate civil liberties. It's the usage of the technology along a trajectory which prioritizes policing and surveillance, imprisonment, and control over social welfare, over individual well-being, over the role of government being to facilitate human interaction and make people's lives better and give people access to things that they couldn't have had without a large overarching structure like education and water and food and medicine. There is a decision-making point right now, and we talk about the Magna Carta, we talk about that shift, that confrontation. You know, the confrontation really comes around when we ask ourselves, what is the point? What are we doing? What is the purpose of this political machine? What is the purpose of sort of the state in general? At that point, we really begin to understand what's going on. Why is there a surveillance state? And what could be done to make it different? So I think that the, you know, just to loop it all the way back, the USA Freedom Act is a good step in terms of providing oversight around the NSA right now. But what we really need is a shift in mentality, you know, a transformational moment where the expense, not just in terms of dollars and cents, but in terms of the concept of freedom and how we interact with each other, when the expense of these types of programs and this type of policing, just from a cost-benefit perspective, no longer becomes worth it. And we need to readjust our priorities as a country and kind of as a people to shift away from this kind of surveillance and this kind of policing and towards something that is what you could sort of generally call a more just world.
Matthew Carragru of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee in Washington.
About 100 Temple University students and Philadelphia community activists gathered at the historic Church of the Advocate last week to demand that the university keep hands off Tony Montara, the professor of African American studies. This past spring, Dr. Montara helped spearhead a protest against Dean Teresa Soufis, who they said was trying to downgrade African American studies. The protest resulted in Temple University backing off its plan. The demonstration also led to the naming of Professor Malefe Asante as chairman of the department. Dr. Asante had joined with Dr. Montara in the protest. However, this summer, the university appeared to retaliate against Dr. Montara, scaling back his access to the campus. Activists say that Dr. Asante, the new chairman, has failed to come to his colleagues' defense. At last week's town hall meeting, activists and students composed a letter to Dr. Asante, rebuking him for abandoning his black colleague. Community activist Patrice Armstead of Building People's Power in North Philadelphia reads part of the statement.
Dr. Asante, you had supported Dr. Montero becoming chair of the department, saying he was as qualified as any person to do so. If you recall, Soufis said she would never accept him as even a nominee to be chair, nonetheless you. Several members of the faculty and the majority of graduate and undergraduate students saw him as qualified to lead the department. In this instance, you stood up against Soufis' rules. Dr. Mazama at the time insisted that Soufis' rules violated the union contract and university policies and practice. The community passionately agreed with yours and Dr. Mazama's judgment, and if he was qualified to be chair of the department, then why is he not qualified to chair dissertation committees? Since the mass protest to make you chair and Dr. Montero's role in mobilizing the community and students, Soufis is creating new rules. We consider her rules unjust, capricious, and designed particularly for Dr. Montero and students he has advised. PAM Africa made it clear that had the community, students, and faculty accepted Soufis' rules, you wouldn't be chairman of the department. Defying her rules made our victory possible. PAM Africa drew our attention to the often made error of underestimating the power of ordinary black folk to bring about change. She asked the meeting to consider what would be Mumia Abu-Jamal's fate if we followed the rules of those who sought to execute him. We are aware of two recent instances where Dean Soufis used rules to harass, bully, and drive black professors out of Temple. First, she attempted using her rules to fire you at least two times. This only compounded the racism of her pointing her finger in your face and stating publicly that she would never accept you as chair. The other is the case of the eminent black philosopher and scholar Dr. Lewis Gordon. So severe and racist was her bullying and attacks upon him that he and his wife, a professor in the political science department, were forced to resign from Temple. Gordon, in his letter of resignation, made it perfectly clear that her use of rules was designed to humiliate, harass, and force him out of the university. At the time, he was one of the three highest-ranking professors in the College of Liberal Arts. We are also aware that the bullying and harassing of black professors goes beyond Temple. In 2002, then-president of Harvard University, Lawrence Summers, dissatisfied with Cornel West's advocacy on behalf of the poor, attacked him personally and his scholarship, saying his advocacy and activism did not fit with Summers' idea of what a Harvard professor should do at his time. West was eventually forced to leave Harvard. At the time, Cornel West was one of the leading professors at Harvard. The origins of black studies in this nation are in the great civil rights and black power movements. Black studies stand on the shoulders of the Birmingham movement's challenge to unjust laws. We are still inspired by the courage of the student sit-ins and boycotts and the opposition to war and poverty. But more than anything, black studies assumed the moral high ground because we spoke for justice. We changed higher education for the better. Everyone benefited. The issues are simple, justice or injustice, and do we have the will and the integrity to do the right thing? We agree with Dr. Lewis Gordon's call for us to oppose institutional bad faith and the structural pathologies that prevent Temple from becoming a great university. We speak in the name of a new humanism that begins with the struggle against white privilege and white supremacy. We look as well to the least of these, our sisters and brothers who are poor and destitute on the outer boundaries of Temple campus. We speak for those being made strangers and outsiders in their own communities. We can win, but whatever the outcome, we will fight.
It wasn't too long ago, I can remember Dr. Monteiro and Dr. Asante standing together, both supported by students and community members, looking like pictures of unity. It appears now from the content and tone of the letter that certainly some students have concluded that Dr. Asante might be stabbing Dr. Monteiro in the back.
You're absolutely correct. Since he's regained his position, he's turned on Dr. Monteiro and he's turned on the community and the same individuals who fought, marched to get him in there. He's basically turned on us.
And how quickly did that occur?
As fast as you can snap your fingers. We kind of surprised because we thought that it was promises that was made, promises with the community, promises that he was going to change the department around and that he was going to get in there and do the right thing. And as fast as he got in there, it's as fast as he's changed and promises that was made is no longer on the table anymore.
What were the main promises that you were depending upon being carried out?
Promises that he was going to work with the community, promises that he was going to assist Dr. Monteiro with getting tenure, promises that basically he was going to stand by Dr. Monteiro and assist him and help him with his continued work that he does in the community. Dr. Monteiro is no longer able to use facilities at Temple University to have classes, to do his Du Bois lectures. He's no longer able to occupy any space at the university. He's been banned from that. So Dr. Asante being chairman, that should have been reinstated. Dr. Monteiro should be able to use space outside of the classrooms to actually teach. He should be able to use classrooms to have programs for students and also people in the community. He's the only professor at Temple University that I know that is banned from using facilities at the university, and Dr. Asante hasn't even assisted him in even being able to use facilities.
Dr. Asante achieved his position because of community and student action and organization. Do you think he might wind up losing it because of the same activism?
Almost definitely. We had a meeting with Dr. Asante, and we laid out our feelings, how we feel, how we feel betrayed, how we feel that he is now working with the dean and that he's working against us. And there's only one outcome that came out of that meeting. We made it clear that either you're going to work with us or you're working against us. And we see now that he's working against us. We gave him some demands. He hasn't gotten back with us with our demands. But if our demands aren't met, then we're going to wage a war. But this time, it'll be against him.
We called Dr. Tony Monteiro and asked if he was disappointed in Dr. Asante's conduct. After all, the two joined together to force Temple University to make Asante's chair of African American Studies only a few months ago.
Yeah, we struggled together along a unbelievable effort by the community and community leaders. And yes, I am disappointed because he seems to have reversed course and taken up another type of stand relative to the building of African American Studies at Temple and connecting that project with the lives and struggles and problems of the black community.
You conducted many programs and projects at Temple. Very few people even imagined that you didn't have tenure. Would these actions result in your work, much of your community work and work with students, coming to a halt?
I don't think any of this will affect my community work and my work with students. You see, because my issue and problem was that I was brought to Temple with the promise that I would be tenured, and it never happened. But what I do, I would do with tenure, without tenure, wherever I am, and have conducted myself that way at any university where I taught. When we were going through this process of the faculty in our department choosing a new chair back in April, I was one of the nominees for the chair of the department. And I was passionately supported in becoming chair of the department by Dr. Sante, which opposed the dean's position that she wouldn't even accept my nomination. So I was supported for chair of the department in the spring, but in the fall, I'm not being supported to head the dissertation committees of graduate students.
Dr. Tony Montero at Temple University in Philadelphia.
A United Nations intervention force and the Congolese army this month defeated the so-called M23 rebel force that has been complicit in the genocide in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The rebels are actually led and armed by neighboring Rwanda, a U.S. ally. Kambale Musavuli of Friends of Congo appeared on Al Jazeera English's Inside Story to help explain the latest developments.
I think that the international pressure worked on making sure that Rwanda stops the support of M23. But I'm still waiting to see Rwanda's will to really be a stakeholder of peace in the Congo. And the way I will know that Rwanda is serious about actually being a stakeholder of peace and stop supporting rebel groups will be for Rwanda to turn over some of the sanctioned individuals they have in Rwanda. You know, the M23 fighters crossed the border. Last year, we have hundreds of them who have received asylum in Rwanda. You have others who have been there for years, like Jules Mutebusi and Laurent Kunda. So seeing that show of good faith will really point out that now the support has completely ended. And cutting that line of Rwanda support of militia groups will help in the stability in the eastern part of Congo.
Rwanda, in a way, has been a symptom, some would argue, of U.S. guilt, remembering the genocide that happened there on President Clinton's watch. Do you think that there is now a seismic change in terms of U.S. attitude to the situation there?
I mean, I'm seeing some indications that there is a shift, but I do not think it is enough. I don't believe in the rhetoric of public statement of American officials around the issues of eastern part of Congo, specifically Rwanda's influence in the east. What I would like to see the U.S. administration do is to hold true to its word. President Barack Obama, when he was in Ghana and when he was in South Africa, stated clearly that Africa does not need strong men. Africa needs strong institutions. The United States policy toward the Great Lakes region has not changed. The United States still supports strong men in the region, Museveni of Uganda, Kagame of Rwanda. How will I know that he has changed? Is by Barack Obama holding true to the law that he wrote as a senator, Public Law 109456. Which clearly stated in Section 105 that the United States, or the Secretary of State, has the power to withhold aid to any nation destabilizing the Congo if they have the evidence to do so. But seeing that they have the evidence, a statement is not enough. I want to see a complete stop of our taxpayers' money going through this government that's continuing to supporting rebel groups in the part of Congo. And, of course, I should thank former Senator Fango, who's now the special envoy, for continuing to push for diplomatic pressure on Rwanda, but statement is not enough. We must go through sanctions. And we see U.S. engagement around Syria with aggressive diplomacy being a way to bring about stability in that country. And I want to see the same type of engagement when it comes to the Congo, with aggressive diplomacy, starting with the commander-in-chief who wrote the law on the Congo.
Well, remembering, too, that this force intervention brigade is composed of South Africans, Tanzanians and Malawian troops at present. Kambali Musavuli, do you welcome this more muscular attitude by the UN?
The genesis of the intervention brigade, this was the Rwandan idea. When the M23 was created and the Rwandan special forces went back to Kigali, Rwanda proposed the idea of having a regional force to go after the negative forces in the Congo, FDLR and any other militia. This idea was taken up by the SADC nations, who say, well, we welcome this idea and we are going to send SADC nations. And the UN just pretty much hijacked the process or took up that idea. They wanted to have the SADC forces to be under the UN command. So it wasn't an idea of the United Nations. It really came out of Rwanda's first saying that we want the intervention force, but it has morphed to what we see now. Of course, military pressure has helped in the past week. We have seen what has actually taken place there. For the local population, they are happy with the stability that they are seeing now, the security, the form of security they're seeing. But military pressure will not be enough to deal with the political problem. And I also want to hint on Ambassador Cohen's point. I think the current configuration of the Congo and the situation on the ground, speaking about economic integration is really difficult when we haven't received justice and accountability for the crimes that have taken place in the eastern part of Congo. Economic integration at the current configuration only rewards the looters without even holding them accountable in the case of Uganda, who have been found liable to owe Congo $10 billion at the International Court of Justice in 2005. They still have not paid the $10 billion to the Congo. In the case of Rwanda, which has committed atrocious crimes and was implicated in the UN mapping exercise report by committing war crimes, crimes against humanity, and possible genocide if proven in a competent court. So it's dangerous to use that idea. I've heard that many times, even from Mary Rabbit's on sticks and carrots, economic integration, when we're not actually holding those who are committing the crimes accountable. It's really rewarding them. But what will be the path for peace that we believe? We think that we need to follow what Kikwete shared. You know, Kikwete said that FDLR need to go back to Rwanda. Most of them did not participate in the genocide. There need to be an inter-Rwanda dialogue. There need to be accountability for the region, and also not to forget the Congo. We have an issue with the Congolese government, which lacks legitimacy and support the Congolese institution in the democratic process to really have the voice in the government so they can deal with the many different issues that we have in the country.
Kambali Musavuli, very, very quickly, does the DRC have a responsibility in this as well? We've heard about the need of unity, the need for economic development. Is there a responsibility on the DRC which has not been exercised?
Yes, and that's what I hinted at my last point, that the reason why the situation has exacerbated to what it is today is because of the lack of legitimacy of the Congolese government. The Congolese state is very weak, and supporting institutions in the Congo, looking at even what's happening there, we are trying to replace Congolese people with international NGOs instead of having Congolese people actually dealing with the issues in the east. So supporting them in the democratic aspiration will be a great way to advance that, and specifically how. 2016, there are presidential elections. We still have not held local elections. Without citizenry, there is no state.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. I'm Glenn Ford, along with co-host Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Melissa Gerson.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.